The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Salner & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor.
This is the Retirement and IRA Show coming to you from beautiful Northern Colorado. Join us as certified financial planner Jim Salner, as well as Colorado State University finance instructor and certified financial planner Chris Stein, teach you about IRAs, 401ks, annuities, Social Security, pension plans, and estate planning in a fun and enjoyable show. Whether you are listening live in Colorado or streaming from their website or iTunes podcast, Jim and Chris want you to know that they're available to help you plan for your retirement. Just visit their website at jimhelps.com. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. And click the Meet the Team button on the homepage. Now here's Jim and Chris with today's show.
Well, hello, everybody, and welcome to the Retirement and IRA Show Q&A edition for this week. To you, it'll seem like a normal timing of the show, but we're recording this just the day after we recorded the last EDU show, since Jim's going to be on the road, headed back to Ohio, driving his fancy new truck and its little trailer full of contents for his new apartment, for his second residence, we'll call it. He's going to split time between Colorado and Ohio. He's talked about that a lot on the show. So to accommodate his travel schedule on the day we would normally record it, we're recording a little early. So I'm only mentioning it because it seems like we just did a recording, because we just did one last night. So for us, it's a little weird. For you, it's going to come out with the same timing. But thanks a lot for listening, Jim. Hopefully your preparation for travel is going pretty well. I know you had some hiccups acquiring the trailer, but you now have said trailer and are, I believe, ready to go. And I hear you have a bed waiting for you now, so you don't have to sleep on the floor when you get there.
I do have a bed. So I'm well, the only thing that's in the apartment right now is a bed and a backpack. And so anyways, yes, I will be leaving tomorrow. Today is Wednesday, the 25th of June, folks. You're going to be listening to this the 28th or after the 28th of June. Mm-hmm. So if anything happens between Wednesday and Saturday that we don't mention, now you know why we're recording this several days in advance. But yes, I will be driving the mighty, massive, manly, and macho Maverick back from Colorado to Ohio, where I originally picked up the car, a truck rather, only to drive it out here to drive it back. Don't ask me about all that, folks, because that should have never happened to begin with, but that's the way I had to do it. But this time I'll be pulling a 5-foot by 8-foot trailer. I have to give myself credit, Chris. I wanted the smallest trailer possible, mm-hmm. because the mighty, manly, massive, macho Maverick might not quite be as powerful as I lead it on to be. And I wanted it to have a good excursion cross country, especially if the weather started approaching 90 to 100 degrees, mm-hmm. As it's been in the not too distant past. So I got it filled last night. It was like putting a Rubik's Cube together and move this here to slide this here to put that there. I don't think I could fit a marble inside the trailer at this point. In fact, I'm going to have my friend open the back when we stop. So I don't have to stand there if everything flies out when you open the ramp door. But I did hire two young boys, never met them, giving them $100 each to get everything from said trailer into my apartment on the third floor. They're the son and good friend of a friend of mine, and they have a window cleaning business. Apparently they had no windows to clean on the day that I'm going to be there, so they will meet me and empty the trailer. So I filled it, they will empty it.
Nice.
So anyways, folks, my excursion into pre-retirement continues. And again, I'm just sharing openly with everybody on the podcast how I am approaching the phase of my life that will be called retirement. It will be different than what most people view retirement to be, because I don't see myself separating from the firm fully, but I do see other people owning the firm and running the firm, but I will be involved still with the firm because, again, I have no wife, no children. The firm is my identity and it gives me purpose and meaning. And I think that's a very important thing to have as we age and people start to look at us more as, well, someone who hasn't died yet, as opposed to someone who is going to be able to continue to help society. And that's a terrible point in your life to pass. And I just want to always feel like I'm contributing to some way, shape, or form. And it does give me purpose. I may complain sometimes. My buddy who's driving out with me has been retired for 3 years and more of the traditional approach folks. And he plays pickleball. I think that's what you do when you retire, Chris. You play pickleball. This guy just plays freaking pickleball. Yeah, I think that's what you do. I don't know. You play pickleball and you eat bonbons. But he's a big pickleball fanatic. And to me, I would rather be working. I just would. I love what I do. And the firm always needs improvement. And it falls on my shoulders. And it's a challenge. And I like a challenge. But it's also something that I don't want to do forever. And someday I will pass on much of the challenging aspect of running the firm to others. But I hope to continue to participate in the podcast and the YouTube channel and the blog, YouTube channel that we don't have yet, but someday will. And anything else that we may do. And I certainly don't want to speak for you, Chris, but you are more than welcome to stay on as well to some degree or another if you wanted to. But it certainly does give me purpose, drive, and meaning. But moving at your 60s, so I'll be moving somewhere in my 60s, is a hell of a lot different than moving when I was in my 30s. I just resigned my commission as a police officer, packed up a moving truck, a U-Haul, a couple of buddies of mine on the SWAT team took a week off. They packed up the truck for me. One of them was an ex-truck driver and drove it out here. His name was Joe. Joe drove the truck nonstop, and I bought my dog. Two dogs, actually, Corbett and Mosby. Excuse me, not Corbett, Buddy and Mosby. Buddy died the first year I was out here. And I didn't think twice about it. I had no job, no nothing. I didn't care. This is totally different. And to me, you have to experience where you may live, the good, the bad, and the ugly of it. And that's what I'm trying to do by having an apartment. When I was living out of Airbnbs, and suitcases, and you could only take two suitcases. When I was living out of Airbnbs and suitcases, I never felt at home. I always felt like I was just on vacation. And if I saw that the weather was going to be bad, I canceled the Airbnb. So I would only reserve Airbnbs that would allow me to cancel right up to usually 2 days before. And I would cancel the Airbnb, and I would just ask for a flight credit because I knew I would fly out there again in the future. It was no harm, no foul. So every time I've been out there, the weather's been nice, things have been good, and that's not an appropriate way. So this is why I'm doing all this, and I'm sharing it with you because if you're thinking of relocating, I said this before and I'll say it again, don't move based on vacation experiences. And there's absolutely positively nothing wrong with renting for a year or two. I'm going to rent for probably 3 years. I kind of do things in threes. So I gave it 3 years of Airbnb and suitcase to see if I liked it enough to now do 3 years of more prolonged stays in Ohio and specifically going out there, even if I know the weather's going to be shitty, I will still go out there because I have to experience the good, the bad, and the ugly. And then I'm also going to start looking at real estate, which is something I purposefully not done. But I want to see what is available. I'm hoping, Chris, I don't find the quintessential perfect home that forces me to come back and make a rash decision.
Yeah.
But I want to make sure my assessment of what I do know of the real estate market, especially with what I'm looking for, living somewhere between Batavia, Ohio, north to Lebanon, Ohio, which is a big stretch of eastern Cincinnati metro. But living somewhere along that stretch on a little bit of acreage with a pond and preferably a ranch home, what does that market look like? And it's, again, I'm trying to be a little bit more pragmatic. And it's just funny how when we're younger, it doesn't matter. You just don't care. But when you're older and you're getting ready to give up what my life has been for the last, gosh, 26 years, by the time I move, it'll be 3 decades. You have to be damn sure, because moving in your 60s is a lot harder as it was to moving in your 30s.
So that's still, why I talk about it. But still a lot easier than doing it in your 80s.
Oh, I mean, right. And that's the other thing. Yeah. I asked Joe today, Joe's our admin, jokingly, but with the degree of seriousness to this, because she and I are good friends. It's like, remind me again, Joe, why I'm doing this. And, you know, after talking with her, it's like, okay, yeah, I get it. That makes sense. And because, yeah, I'm questioning sometimes, is this worth it? Should I do this? But if I don't do it now, I'll never do it in my 70s and 80s, mm-hmm. especially if I'm still a bachelor. And I just don't want to be that Debbie Downer that my dad warned me to warn you guys about. The Debbie Downer is the person in his retirement community who had money. It wasn't an issue of money. They didn't have the ability to enjoy it anymore. Well, I don't want to be the Debbie Downer who at 78 is like, oh my God, why didn't I do this in my late 50s and 60s when you had this opportunity? Why didn't you do this? I don't want to be that guy. Uh-huh. So that's why I'm doing what I'm doing. Okay, hopefully you guys can learn from this for those of you who are thinking of relocating in retirement. Just don't do it based on a vacation experience. Uh-huh. Make sure before you commit. I kind of call it, I'm dating Ohio before I decide to marry Ohio. And I will date for several years and make sure I like it before I say I do. Okay.
Yeah.
I sent you, Chris, to start. We mm-hmm. got a couple more PSAs. So I normally read them, but this time I wanted to send them to Chris to see if he felt the PSAs were worth addressing. So he thought they were. So why don't you start with the two okay. PSAs, and then we'll jump into Social Security question before getting into some annuity questions.
Okay. That sounds good. So the first one that Jim sent me came in just yesterday, actually. And let's see if there's no hint that I can share with you. Just starts, hi, guys, longtime listener. We live in Central Florida, and I wanted to share my experience with our local Social Security office. I was able to make a next day appointment after about 15 minutes on hold to apply for Medicare. I'm 68. My wife is 67. I retired in March of 2024, and my wife is retiring next month. We've been covered by employer plans, so this is the first time applying for Medicare, which explains them being 68 and 67, why they're just doing it for the first time now. They've been on employer plans. So if you're on a qualified employer plan, you are able to delay the initial sign-up without penalty, which normally would occur if you didn't sign up at 65. But they continue. The process for us was extremely easy. I was able to show our employer coverage and filled out SSA 44 at the same time. Within 2 weeks, we received new Social Security cards and an approval for reduced IRMA. Not sure if this is an outlier, but our experience was really smooth. Keep up the great work, and I, for one, enjoy the banter. So that's good. So I when Jim sent me this, I wanted to read it because I think it is appropriate for us to acknowledge the successes, right? That certainly, especially when you're talking about problems at an entity, an institution in this case, the Social Security Administration, and people struggling with customer service issues, which has been a bit of an ongoing problem, but has accelerated in the past year or two, I would say. It's been a heavier and heavier burden on them for the same reason that Social Security payments are becoming precarious, we might call them, as far as the Social Security Trust Fund, which at this point is expected to be exhausted without changes being made by about 2034. The reason why that's the case is the baby boomers, right? The baby boomers retiring, reaching Social Security age, claiming Social Security benefits that they're entitled to, and that money to support the level of promises that were made to them and others that are already on Social Security are supplemented by that trust fund. Obviously, Social Security receives an enormous amount of money every month from our payroll withholding, but more is flowing out than is flowing in, which is why the cushion, which we have built up over time, called the trust fund, is being drained. And that's what's being, you know, anticipated or predicted to run out by 2034, unless there's changes implemented, and hopefully there will be. But I say it like that because as more and more people, quote, burden the system by claiming benefits to which they're entitled, they're not a burden. They're just claiming what they've been promised and what they've earned, right? There's a lot more people making claims and there's a lot more activity. And when you've got a lot more, quote, customer activity at your business, if we want to think of it as such, customer service can be a challenge. That's exactly what we've been experiencing over the past few years is wait times. COVID didn't do anybody any favors because all the offices tried to go remote and all that. Luckily, we're over that hump. But in a lot of areas of the country, getting an appointment at your local office is difficult or delayed from what it should be. And then once you're there, the information you're getting is not always robust, we'll call it. So kudos to the office in Central Florida. I'm sure there's more than one in what's considered Central Florida, but I'll give them a shout out. If this is their typical process, this is awesome to hear that someone was able to make an appointment for next day, go in, be able to submit their documentation, in this case, to sign up for Medicare, which Social Security handles that as well, getting their IRMA adjusted, right, the income-related monthly adjustment amount, using the SSA 44 approach, which we've talked about numerous times on the show. So I do appreciate this person sending this in, this good news. I don't want to be just, you know, saying that it's nothing but bad news, because I admit I've heard from a number of people, I haven't read an email from them, but I've heard from others that things have gone smoothly, either via online application for benefits or, like in this listener's case, a face-to-face in the office went well. And there's an office within a 3.5-hour drive from where we record that I've also heard really good things about. So they're out there. So always remember, you can go to any Social Security office. You don't have to go to the one that's closest to you. So if you hear others, friends, associates, what have you, that have had a good experience in an office and it's within your ability to reach it, right, through reasonable travel, if you're having troubles, you might consider going to a different office, right? Totally allowed. It's a national or federal program. There's no such thing as going to your, quote, local office or being restricted to your local office. They're all available to you wherever they are. The program is the same in every single state. So appreciate it. Thanks a lot, listener, for sending this one in. The second PSA, much, much shorter here, I think, is in response to, they sent us in information. I guess this is a follow-up to a previous PSA, because here in the last couple of weeks, we talked about a case where they sent in information about their claiming experience for Social Security for, I believe it was the husband who had a birthday on the first of the month. And it kind of surprised me. There's a little bit of new information in there that I hadn't realized that in this case, just to recap, get everybody up to speed. The husband had a birthday on January 1st, turned 70 on January 1st and went in and claimed, and they gave him a benefit of, you know, turned on his benefits as of January, which if you, remember, that's what happened. But the surprising thing was the first benefit payment they expected to happen by January 31st, where normally the benefit from January isn't paid until the second, third, or fourth month of February. So there was that little tidbit that for whatever reason in their particular circumstances, because I don't think this is typical, that the first benefit month got paid early, you know, a couple weeks before you would normally expect it. So that was the surprise. And then the second part of that is what was implied in that email is that they considered him turning 70 the month before he actually turned 70 because his birthday was on the first of the month. And I had made the comment that I was under the impression that the first of the month, you know, issue, if you will, essentially gave people born on the first of the month a little advantage if they were claiming at 62, because if you don't know, when you are first claiming benefits, if you're claiming at in the first month of eligibility, your first month of eligibility is the month you are 62 the entire month. So it's not technically the month you turn 62. It's the month after for almost everybody, unless you're born on the first of the month. When you're born on the first of the month, they consider you 62 that entire month. And so you effectively have access to benefits a month earlier than people born the second through the end of the month in your birth month. Just a weird anomaly for the first of the month. But I thought that was the only benefit, and I made mention that I didn't think it affected your full retirement age and ultimately your delayed retirement credit situation. And in the original email that I'm recapping here, the recap's going kind of long, but it's relevant. They mentioned he, you know, they claimed at 70, but I was unsure if they gave him delayed retirement credits all the way up to 70 or if he got to 69 and 11 months and missed out on a month of delayed retirement credits because he claimed kind of the month before because of this first of the month issue. And she wrote back. Okay, so here's the response finally after my long recap. Good morning, Mr. Solnier and Mr. Stein. Very formal. Jim and Chris, in reference to May 31st Q&A, I would like to provide clarification to Social Security claiming with a first of the month birthday. My husband turned 70 years old on February 1st. I apologize. My memory was wrong. I said January 1st. It was February 1st. My husband applied for age 70 benefit. His benefit was received with all of the delayed retirement credits. So that confirms what I was wondering. Do they not only give you benefit by being born on the first of the month, benefit of the first month of eligibility at 62 being the month before it would be for others, they consider you reaching your full retirement age the month before you actually reach it? And they're going to calculate delayed retirement credits based on you achieving the age in the prior month. What I mean by the prior month is even though he's born February 1st, official, it's right on his birth certificate. We know when he's born in the month of February. They consider him turning 62 in January, in the year he turned 62. They consider him turning his full retirement age in January, not February. And then here they're confirming that indeed for delayed retirement credit calculations, they gave him full credit as being 70, even though they turned on the benefit in January instead. So there's benefit all around when you're born on the first of the month, which personally pleases me. And they said that in the email. They said, Chris should be smiling. And I am, because here's a case where I'm personally going to benefit because I was born on April 1st. I'm one of the crowd that was born on the first of the month. And so I'm going to reach my first month of eligibility, which I don't intend to claim Social Security at 62. But if I did, I'd be able to claim it as of March instead of April. I'll reach my full retirement age of 67 in March of that year instead of April. And then I'll only have to wait until March of 2037. I'm doing some quick math in my brain. Yeah, 2037 to get my full delayed retirement credits and my full age 70 benefit instead of waiting till April, which is what I'd have to do if I was born between April 2nd and April 30th. So, being born on the first of the month, pays benefits, I guess we could say. Accelerates things a little bit. So really appreciate you sending in clarification from that, because the original email, it wasn't expressly stated that he got all the delayed retirement credits. So I was a little nervous. He gave up a month. Not that it would have made a big difference in the benefit, but I was just super curious. Do they really give you the delayed retirement credits, even though you didn't turn 70 until February? They consider that weird rule. And this all comes from was set into place as far as the rule back long, long ago in the 1800s, actually. There was a court case with the federal government involved that had something to do with the determination of someone's age when they were born on the first of the month. And the court ruled that they were, you know, had reached the age, technically the prior month. I don't remember all the details. There's a big story behind it. Maybe we'll talk about it on some show again. But yeah, great. Thanks for phoning this in. Everybody else out there in listener land who's born on the first of the month, you got this little extra benefit that lingers with you all the way until age 70 for Social Security claiming. So now that I've churned through more time than I intended on these PSAs, Jim, are you ready to we'll go over, I think we have an actual Social Security question, and then we can get into some annuity questions. Totally up to you.
Absolutely. We might as well get into the Social Security question like we always do. And don't forget, folks, and Chris, and I know you know this, that Social Security is a form of an annuity. Mm-hmm. So Chris answering these PSAs and answering Social Security questions is still technically tying into Annuity Awareness Month. Just yeah. Wanted to point that out. Okay, the actual question. Hi, Jim and Chris. Let's see if he starts with a question. Yep, at the end he put it, so we'll do it now. Here is my state hint, if you still have it. Now, remember, folks, the overriding consensus, keep the state hints. People like watching Chris flail like a fish out of water trying to guess the answer. But ixnay ChatGPT. So ChatGPT's been relegated to the... Where does a computer algorithm go, Chris?
Not quite sure. Somewhere in digital land.
The trash heap of digital land. And Chris is playing just against himself, and you guys can play along. He is from the state where you're not a history fan.
You always say that. I pay attention some history.
All right, I'm going to go and say you're not going to get this. Now, sit your hands under that bulbous butt of yours and don't click anything into Google.
Okay.
I am from the state where Sam Houston and Davy Crockett both served in the U.S. House of Representatives.
That's a weird one, because Davy Crockett is clearly a Tennessee reference, but Sam Houston in my mind is all connected to Texas. So I guess the question is, which one of those two was in the other state in the House of Representatives? So I guess I have a 50-50 shot, maybe. That's the only hint I get? That's it? That's just the whole question?
That's it. Wait a minute. He also said Sam Houston later became governor of this state.
Oh. Well, to me, that means it's got to be Texas, because Sam Houston was not the governor of Tennessee. He was the governor of Texas. So, but I don't know why Davy Crockett would be in the House of Representatives of Texas, I'll go with Texas.
That's your final answer?
I'll go with Texas, yeah.
Okay. Tennessee. Both Davy Crockett and Sam Houston were initially in politics in Tennessee before moving to Texas. Sam Houston was in the House of Representatives and served as governor before he moved to Texas, and eventually became president of the Republic of Texas and later governor of that state. To this day, he's the only person to have ever served as the governor of two different states.
I had no idea that he was the governor of Tennessee as well. Huh. See, I learned something new on the show.
Yep. See that?
Yeah. But I was in the ballpark, right? I you say I don't know anything about it, but, you know, I think my answer was respectable.
Well thought out and well reasoned. I'll give you that. Yeah. I will definitely give you that.
Okay.
Okay. I have what I think is a simple Social Security question, but I seem to be getting conflicting results when I try to find the answer online. Go figure, Chris, online, conflicting answers. Yeah. So I thought I would ask the most knowledgeable people I know. Well, that doesn't help us on any.
Did they not answer you and then you came to us?
Yeah, right. Because we are not the most knowledgeable people you know. Okay. My wife and I are both 66. Full retirement age for us is 66 and 10 months. She claimed her Social Security a couple of years ago at age 64. I'm planning on waiting until age 67 to start my benefit. Her benefit is approximately $1,000 a month. But my benefit at my full retirement age, which again, folks, is for him, 66 and 10 months, will be $3,850 per month. So when I eventually claim, she will switch to the highest spousal benefit. My question is about the mechanics of this. Will Social Security automatically move her to the higher spousal benefit? Or do we need to apply for this change when the time comes? If so, can this be done via her online account, or does it require an in-person visit? Also, and if you need a copy of this email, because he asks a lot of questions, also, if we do not need to apply, when should this be done? Can she apply to change to the spousal benefit at the same time that I apply to start my benefit? Or do we need to wait until I am actually receiving my benefit, and then she can apply to change hers? It seems like if we wait until the point to apply, she may miss a few months of higher payments. Thank you so much for your assistance. We'll call him George.
Okay. So he's not asking about the benefit itself. He's talking about the mechanics of her switching from her own benefit to a spousal benefit. And it's technically not a switch. She's going to continue receiving her own, and then they're going to pile on top of that what's called a spousal offset. So, looks to me like she might get another $700 a month or something like that is going to be the bump. So technically, we're talking about mechanics here. She's going to keep getting her $1,000, and then they're going to add $700 or so as the spousal offset once the spousal turns on. Now, the mechanics of turning it on. This is where things are a little fuzzy, I believe, because I've not seen a formal way where you can check easily that the two of you are known to be married in the Social Security system. I haven't seen, and here's another one I'll put out to our listeners. Have any of you seen in your online Social Security account an indication of you are married to such and such? You know, we see that you're married to whoever. That would be a lovely thing to see in there. And the reason is, if they know you're married, when you file for your own benefit, you said at 67, they will automatically turn on the spousal for your wife. If for some reason they don't know you're married, you'll have to intervene manually. So what I would recommend you do, I believe this would probably be the best way to not risk missing out on a few months, like he said, because he said, well, should I wait until I'm actually collecting and then we contact him? And once you're actually collecting, by the time you contact them and have the spousal turned on for her, there might be a couple months. Now, they're going to probably fix it so that any of the months you miss, they're going to pay you depending on when you call. But to avoid that completely, what I would do is have her call or contact Social Security and see if it shows, explain the situation, say, hey, my spouse is going to claim here in the next year or so. Do you show that we're married in the system so I'll automatically get the spousal offset? And maybe they'll, at that point, we'll say, well, no, we don't. Send us a copy of the marriage certificate. And again, I wouldn't send in an original copy or the only copy you have, because you're likely not going to get it back again. But hopefully, if you've been married for a long time, I suspect that they're going to show that you're married in the system, and they'll confirm, yeah, when he files, the spousal offset will automatically happen. Something like that. Same thing happens if they know you're married and your spouse passes away. They'll switch you to the survivor benefit automatically if they know you're married. What I can't understand is why it's so hard to know in the system that it shows you're married. unless I've missed it, unless somewhere in the account. But, and I guess I haven't gone into my own for the last year or so. Maybe I'll hop in there and see if it shows that I'm married to my wife. But I don't think it does. I don't think there's any mention of that at all in there. So that's essentially how it's going to work. If they know you're married, it'll be, should be. That's always a better word to use. Should be. Because there's glitches that happen all the time. Should happen automatically. If they don't know you're married, then you might want to, ahead of time, so it does happen automatically, get the two of you recognized as being married in their system so that it does happen automatically. And if you don't do that, then you'll have to go in, claim. If they don't show you're married, she'll have to show proof she's married to you. Then it'll all get cleaned up that way. But I think being a little proactive might be the best way to do it. And hopefully they show you're married and they'll just say, oh no, it'll be automatic. No problem. So hopefully that's the case.
All right. Fair enough. I think you did a good job.
Oh, thank you.
Except
I missed the trivia. But I got close.
But it was well thought out, though. I think our listeners appreciated how much you analyzed it. Okay. So I'm looking at the three questions that I pulled.
Mm-hmm.
So when I find them in the Outlook folder, I just double-click them. Mm-hmm. And then they open up in a separate window.
Yeah.
And then I can send that window to Joe after I answer the question. Joe's the girl who writes mm-hmm. up everything.
That's a good way to do it.
As I have the windows open in front of me, I can see all three of them.
Mm-hmm.
There's one that's very, very short, one that's medium, and one that's longer. And they're in that order. Hmm. I just thought that looked really cool. Hmm. So I'm going to start with the short, which is, looks like one sentence. To the much longer one, which is a long one, in that order. So I just figured I would share that. Or do you want me to go from longest to shortest? Your choice.
I have no preference.
You have no preference. Then we'll start with what my original idea was, the short one. Okay. No state hint. He's like me, pithy to the point. No BS. I appreciate your diving into details regarding annuities. But I think it would be useful for your listeners if you would answer, at least at a high level, what problem are we trying to solve for the different types of annuities you're talking about? You say you sometimes recommend these different types, but usually a single premium immediate annuity, I think. Oh, you're correct, folks. We generally, a listener, SPIAs and MIGAs, with MIGAs actually being more popular with a lot of our listeners than SPIAs, which we'll explain in a minute why. But what circumstances would cause you to recommend any of the different types of annuities you have covered? Thanks for all you do. I thought that was a pretty good question, and it's going to allow us to kind of solidify again what I've been trying to teach you this month. And we didn't get a chance to finish, so it's going to bleed into a little bit of July because I want to close, complete the circle. We started with SPIAs, and we're circling right around and tying in living benefits, which is an attempt to keep an annuity as a noun and not a verb, but provide a lifetime stream of guaranteed income. Chris and I mentioned listener and listeners in general, that all annuities are insurance products. First of all, get that through your heads. Annuities are insurance products. They're not investments. The closest to an investment would be a variable annuity because your money can go up, it can go down, and to a lesser degree, the RILA annuities, which we spoke about this week. But at their core, they are insurance products, and they are providing some type of insurance protection. The two main types of insurance protection, at least at my firm, that we recommend annuities for are lifetime streams of guaranteed income and principal protection. those are the two risks that we are going to purchase insurance for. The lifetime stream of guaranteed income, which I affectionately call the bottomless cup of coffee, I don't think that needs any explanation. It's just a stream of income that you cannot outlive, no matter how long you live. The guarantee of principal is also very important in a distribution portfolio. And keep this in mind. If you are in accumulation and maybe to a degree a transition or Venn diagram person, so you're transitioning from accumulation to decumulation, an annuity may not be appropriate for you. You may not give a damn about principal protection or a degree of principal protection. And you're certainly not interested right now in a lifetime stream of guaranteed income if you're still working and generating income. So annuities probably are not going to be appropriate for you. Now, in the Venn diagram section, you may want to consider matching some annuities, like a multi-year guaranteed annuity, a MYGA, for the principal protection to ensure when you exit the Venn diagram, the overlay period between accumulation and decumulation, where you're kind of swinging from one vine to another like Tarzan, and you're at that pinnacle where one hand is holding one vine and the other hand is holding the other vine, and you haven't quite let go. That's kind of the Venn diagram. Maybe at that point, having a multi-year guaranteed annuity that's going to provide the liquidity you need the minute you let go of the first vine and you're holding on to the second vine called retirement, that could be an appropriate time to use a MYGA. But in distribution, in retirement, Chris is going to explain in a second the value, because he's asking, when would we use these, Chris? So you're going to explain to him when we generally recommend lifetime streams of guaranteed income after we run our analysis. Where do we generally recommend and under what circumstances? I will mention to him how we would use a MYGA, multi-year guaranteed annuity, which is one of the other annuities we spoke about. That is a fixed annuity with a degree of principal protection, and the degree is full principal protection. There's no risk to your money inside a MYGA, short of the insurance company going out of business. And even then, you might be bailed out whole if you have inside the MYGA less than what your state guarantee account is. It just may take you a little bit of time to get those dollars. But we use MYGAs and match them in our positioning portfolios. When we're trying to break up the one big accumulation portfolio and begin breaking it into these various spending segments, positioning in my eyes is a form of bucketing or time segmented investing. But rather than segmenting it solely on time, the dollars you need the first 5 years, the second 5 years, the third 5 years, which is typical bucketing or time segmentation, I like to break your dollars into spending. The dollars you need for your delay period MDF, the dollars you need for your post-delay period, the dollars you need for your fund number, your go-go phase, slow-go phase, no-go phase, the dollars you need for aging and LTC and a buffer. I like to break your portfolio into those positions, and we will use MYGAs to match a spending ladder. So MYGAs will generally pay more interest than bonds. The insurance company has to, especially government bonds. If you could get more interest from a five-year U.S. government bond, why would you buy a multi-year guaranteed annuity from an insurance company? You wouldn't. You would just buy it from the U.S. government if you have full faith and credit in the U.S. government paying that back. And that's becoming questionable. But if the U.S. government can't pay back their debt, trust me, every other freaking bond out there has gone to hell in a handbasket as well. So the insurance companies will pay more than what you're going to get in a bond. And since we are trying to get as much interest as we can, but maintaining 100% principal protection, I will use a MYGA in that instance for the insurance benefit of principal protection. Chris, give them a little bit of a background on the insurance protection of a SPIA. Where would we try to use a SPIA?
So a SPIA stands for Single Premium Immediate Annuity, and it is kind of the what I like to describe as the cleanest, purest form of an annuity, because it's a simple relationship between you and the insurance company where you hand a lump sum of money to the insurance company. In return, they give you a promise of lifetime income payments. Now, true, there are SPIAs that you can intentionally structure for less than a lifetime, but what we're looking at using SPIAs for is for longevity protection. And by that, I mean, we have, as you all know, if you've listened for any period of time, as part of our philosophy, the thought that your most important expenses, what we call your minimum dignity floor expenses, should be covered not by an asset that can run out, like regular asset distributions, but rather by an income stream that will last as long as you do, because your minimum dignity floor expenses are going to last as long as you do. So that means for your life, and if you're a couple, for the life of both of you. So that's where a SPIA can come in, because we like to have secure income covering your minimum dignity floor expenses, because that achieves what I just described. And so we will, you know, generally see people with a period of time where they maybe can cover their minimum dignity floor expenses, waiting for their Social Security or pensions to turn on, something like that. And then they do reach a realization or a time in their life where, even though they've turned on all their naturally available secure income, they still need more to protect that minimum dignity floor. We see SPIAs as a perfect tool to use for that. And so we're talking to people generally who are over 70, sometimes somewhere between 70 and 85, I think is the sweet spot where people realize, you know, I probably, you know, could use a little more secure income to protect my minimum dignity floor expenses. I don't have quite enough. I had enough before, or I was using a different method of covering them. But now if I want to, kind of reduce that longevity risk element as it particularly pertains to minimum dignity floor expenses, now's the time to maybe engage in this relationship with the insurance company to hand them a pile of money, and they in return will promise to pay me an agreed upon amount for the rest of my life, no matter how long I live. So if I live an extended period of time where my own money would have run out, the insurance company is backing it and will continue to pay me, protecting my minimum dignity floor. So that's kind of the philosophical and the mechanics behind how we would, you know, fold a SPIA into a retirement situation.
Perfect. Now he says, well, how about some of the other annuities? How and when and where would you use those? Well, let's look at fixed annuities, specifically fixed indexed annuities. Where would we use an FIA? Well, if you go back and listen to the FIA show, we kind of get into it a bit there. But to summarize, because fixed indexed annuities will have a penalty period, if you buy them through a broker or insurance agent, you will most likely have a 5, 7, or 10 year penalty period, although 3 year, 2 year, and 1 year FIAs do exist. I don't think they're worth it, especially the amount of paperwork and effort and time it takes to open an annuity, which is ridiculous. And if you've ever opened an annuity, you know what I mean. It's not going to be worth it for something you're going to hold for a year or two. So generally speaking, 5, 7, or 10 years. So using my same logic of spending segmented investing, if you knew you're segmenting your spending and you have some spending that you anticipate needing in 5, 7, or 10 years or longer, and you feel comfortable holding a product that's not going to allow you access to your money without having to pay a penalty if you're in a broker-sold product, or a market value adjustment and or penalty if you're in an advisory sold product. In other words, you have a fiduciary investment advisor. They put you in a fixed indexed annuity that they're going to charge their AUM fee on. Those are called advisory annuities, or quote unquote fee-based annuities. And if you want the potential for a better return than a MIGA, I would be okay with these. And I say potential because there's no guarantee in your time period, the fixed indexed annuity, which operates very similar to a 100% buffered ETF. There's no downside risk. Zero is your hero. But the insurance company is going to cap your upside potential. If you need that much principal protection, you can't take principal risk. When the penalty term of this annuity expires, you need no less than what you put in. The fixed indexed annuity could be a viable option instead of a MIGA. But as I tried to point out, I don't know which one's going to be the better option. It sounds very appealing, doesn't it, Chris, to say, oh, I get a 9% cap rate to the S&P or a 10% or an 11% cap rate to the S&P. But 1-0, the following year, it wipes that out and a 10% becomes on average maybe a 5% over that two-year period. I know it's not quite that much, but you get the point. And I don't know if getting a MIGA that might be paying you a fixed 5% a year for the hold is a better option. So I said you might want to consider both. Where I don't think fixed indexed annuities are appropriate is as an accumulation vehicle. I just don't. If you don't need the money for 10, 15, 20, 25 years, yet from an emotional standpoint, you can't handle an investment, temporary investment loss. I say temporary because a well-diversified stock ETF or mutual fund, especially a passively managed ETF, like the total stock market index or something, that's not going to go under. I'm sorry, it's not. It's going to have volatility, but it's never going to stay down forever. If it does, it's because it's the zombie apocalypse and businesses aren't making profit anymore, but you're a zombie now eating other people, so it doesn't matter. But if you are in the accumulation phase, I don't feel fixed indexed annuities are appropriate. You should be able to handle some degree of investment loss. And we'll get into that with RILAs in a second. But I do feel, again, if you can match the need of principal protection to the penalty period, it possibly may pay you more than a MIGA. But I'm not 100% certain. Anything you want to add, Chris?
No, I think that all seems reasonable to me.
So then RILAs were the other type of annuity we chatted about. Registered index-linked annuities. Those are from this week. The bastard one-night stand child between a fixed indexed annuity and a variable annuity. A RILA, I could go so far as to say, could be appropriate in the accumulation phase. Because with the RILA, you stand a chance of losing some money. So your upside potential is greater. The RILA is the equivalent of a buffered ETF. Not the 100% buffered ETF. That's the fixed indexed annuity. The RILA is the insurance company's answer to structured products that were offered by banks for years and still are. And buffered ETFs, which are relatively new compared to structured products. But it is a way for the insurance company to say, hey, rather than guaranteeing 100% principal protection, we'll give you a degree of principal protection. And they generally come similar to buffered ETFs. 10% downside protection, 20%, 30%, and I told you I know of one that offers 40%. I think if you're buying the 40% one as an accumulation, you're crazy. The cap rate is probably about the same as 100% buffered ETF. It gets to the point where the buffer is so great, you just buy the 100% one at that point. You're not going to get any higher return. But if you can say, hey, I want to wipe out the first 10, 12, 15, even 20% drop in the market. I'm in the Venn diagram. I'm swinging between the two vines. I'm holding on, but I'm not quite in retirement yet. I want some growth potential. Or if you are an accumulation person and you just freak out over markets going down and you don't know why, and you see your statements dropping and you panic all the time, so you stay in cash, you may actually like a RILA with a 20 or 30% or if need be 40% downside buffer. You still can lose, but if you have the 30% downside buffer and the market's down 25, you walk away with a big fat zero at that 12-month period. Remember, these are usually set every 12 months. Oh, horror. Then it will reset with another cap rate. And then if the market is up 20 and your cap rate was 9, I'm just making these numbers up, your cap rate was 9, you walk away with that 9. You don't get the full 20. But remember, when the market was down 25 the year before, you didn't lose anything. So you are significantly ahead even of the person who did get the full 20 rebound, because there's still no way near breaking even. And you're already ahead. So that I could see a RILA in an accumulation product for someone in the transition phase or someone in the accumulation phase who just freaks out. Now, that said, you know, for a variety of reasons, if you listen to the RILA show, I still favor buffered ETFs that work in a similar fashion. But that's because I value liquidity. And if you are in the accumulation phase, and this is money for retirement, you don't need liquidity. And I would go so far as to say then you might want to consider the RILA, because the RILA does have higher cap rates than a buffered ETF, because the RILA doesn't come with that liquidity. You're going to have to hold it for 5, 7, or 10 years. Now, that's if it's inside an IRA. If it's in a brokerage account, listen to the show recently, I would put my stake back into the ETF realm because of the more favorable tax treatment for a variety of reasons. Listen to the show. So again, the RILA, in certain circumstances, I can see it being used, and that's how you might want to consider it. Anything you want to add, Chris?
No, I think that kind of rounded out most of the ones we've talked about recently and kind of the use cases. So I think I'm good.
And then the final was variable annuities, which we didn't talk about a whole hell of a lot. And I have a hard time trying to recommend VAs anymore. I'm sorry, folks. They don't really do much. The investments inside them, usually pretty crappy compared to the ones that you can get elsewhere. The separate accounts inside a variable annuity are paying the insurance company a fee to be in there. So generally speaking, I can't prove this, but my gut tells me insurance companies really looking for the companies that'll pay them the highest fee, not necessarily have the best performance. Yes, they can come with a death benefit or an enhanced death benefit, but that comes at an additional cost that I find questionable value in. The variable annuities could have a living benefit, and we'll talk about them next week on the EDU show. But they've really been curtailed from when they were great in 2007, 8, and 9. And I, in full disclosure, I've told you this many times, have a Roth IRA with a variable annuity with a living income benefit that if that benefit still existed, it exists for me because I've been grandfathered in. I would still be putting clients in it to this day, but it doesn't. It was so good back then. Because it was so good, it's been greatly curtailed down. So I don't see anything great about a variable annuity. I'm sorry. I just don't. I think if you're looking for investment, go buy an investment, because the variable annuity can lose money. It's no buffer in there. You can have a separate rider for a guaranteed accumulation value on the VA, but that really just brings you back to whole if after 10 years you are down and just show me a 10-year period where you're down. It's slim to none. I just, again, don't see anything to love about variable annuities. And I'm probably making a lot of brokers and insurance agents cringe on this, but it might also explain why RILAs are much more popular than VAs. If you are an accumulation investor and you're thinking of buying a VA inside an IRA, make sure that the death benefit or the living benefit is something you're paying for, because your fees on that annuity will be 2.5% to 3.5%. And you just better make sure that it's worth it, because you could probably earn more on your own. Remember, there's no principal protection in these products. Now, if you have a tax situation, I could concede that there might be an instance where a variable annuity outside of an IRA, a non-qualified variable annuity, to park some money in to keep any type of interest or earnings being declared, because while it's inside the VA, you don't have to pay taxes on it. Perhaps to optimize for ACA premium tax credits, avoid IRMA, or maximize Roth conversions. For some temporary reason, a VA, and I favor what are called investment-only variable annuities, IOVA, IOVAs, they don't come with death benefits and living benefits, so their fees are significantly lower. That's why they call them investment-only variable annuities. It gives you that wrapper, that insurance tax wrapper, rather, not insurance wrapper, it's an insurance policy, but you're buying it for that tax wrapper outside of an IRA to reduce any type of interest or dividends that you were generating on money, because those interest and dividends were screwing you up trying to get ACA or IRMA or something. And then when the ACA, IRMA, or Roth conversions are done, get the money out of the VA, because from a tax standpoint, it stinks compared to investing that money in a regular capital investment. That's my opinion on VAs. Anything you got, Chris?
No, unless, you know, you're right. Historically, there have been times when VAs had some attractive other benefits beyond the core functioning of a VA, those income benefits that you're talking about. Lacking that, though, to me, they don't have a lot of appeal. So, sometimes, just to defend them a little, one might have a different kind of annuity that is even worse for you, because you don't need what it had, or it was has super high fees or whatever. And because it's you have some tax consequences or some other reasons you're not wanting to distribute, I've seen people exchange into an investment VA for some benefits there, but it's just saying, let's go to something that's less bad, right? This is what we have. We don't like, it's not doing well. It's bad for some reason for us. Let's move this thing over. And the best we can do without consequences is to move it into a VA. So maybe that's a time when it becomes attractive, only because it's, you know, more attractive than the bad thing that you're in right now.
Perfect. Okay.
So let me be clear. Was that the short one?
Well, I didn't say the answer was going to be short, but the question was short.
Clearly. Okay.
Clearly. We'll probably just do this one and then wrap up.
Okay.
All right. So this is the medium one in length. Hopefully the answer will go quicker.
Yeah.
Hi, Jim and Chris. I have enjoyed listening and learning from your podcast for several years now. I started listening shortly after Jim's stroke. Oh, thank you, listener.
A while ago.
And Chris was doing the podcast and Jim was expected back soon. When Jim came back, I sensed he was experiencing difficulties with words. Now, I have difficulty with words, listeners, all the time.
I bet he's getting ready to point that out. He's learned that's just Jim.
So what you thought was caused by my stroke, listener, was just the way I talk. I noticed Jim was having difficulties with his words and thoughts. And I was touched by the compassion. Oh, please, did your mother write this? I was touched by the compassion that Chris showed. and helping Jim during his recovery. Did you show me compassion?
I was a little less harsh in calling out the Jimisms.
Less harsh. Okay.
In the Jimisms, so that could be interpreted as compassion. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Well, I'll have to go back and listen. I didn't realize that you were being compassionate.
They were touching, yeah.
I didn't notice. I am impressed with Jim's progress and his recovery. Thank you. When did he write this? 2023. Wow. Okay.
Wow, you pulled out an oldie here.
Yeah, this came back from the... I told you this. I just throw them all in the annuity folder and I ignored them. I'm impressed with the progress of Jim's recovery and he seems complete. And he's doing well and handles complex topics now on the podcast that benefits the listeners. Thank you, listener, for that. I mean, you wrote this several years ago, but thank you. For those who don't know, I did suffer a massive stroke in 2020, and it was scary, and I don't know why, but I had a full recovery. The neurologist who did the thrombectomy that saved my life said I had less than a 1% chance. He's never seen anything like it. I should be dead or paralyzed, and I'm neither. But thank you, listener, for that. Okay. I want to give you my state. Well, we were doing state hints back then. Mm-hmm. I'm from a state where almost 1/3 of its southern area is referred to as Little Egypt. Oh, you'll never get this because I never even heard of that before. She gives the answer. See if you can stump Chris with this one.
The southern third.
It's called Little Egypt.
I wonder by whom, because I've never even heard of that before. The southern third. How about Nevada?
I would have went with that because Egypt, I just pictured desert.
Yeah.
I've driven through the southern third of this state. I will be driving shortly through this southern third again on my way to Ohio.
Oh.
Illinois. I never heard of Illinois called Little Egypt, especially the southern third. It's not like there's pyramids and sand.
No, but maybe the Mississippi or Missouri going through there is whatever it is in Illinois.
Oh, like the Nile?
Kind of like the Nile, maybe, with all the farms to the sides and stuff. I don't know. I'm just guessing. That's possible. I was thinking sand.
That's what I was thinking. All right. My question is about annuities. 7 years ago, I purchased a fixed indexed annuity. She gives the name. I'm not going to name it. I purchased a fixed indexed annuity, which features a bonus, or what you call bogus. I'm going to have to talk about that too, because I didn't mention. Yes, whenever you hear the name bonus annuity, just substitute the word bonus with bogus. So every time you're being sold a bogus annuity, aka bonus annuity, and the agent or advisor keeps saying the bonus does this, the bonus does that, the bonus, just substitute the name in your head with bogus. And at the end of their presentation, see if you still want it, because bonus annuities are bogus annuities as far as I'm concerned. Okay. This annuity featured a bogus annuity benefit, and she said in the 20% range. Mm-hmm. This annuity represents 1/4 of my portfolio. I have $3 million. So a quarter of three is what, Chris?
$750.
She's got about $750 in this annuity, folks. However, as I think of things, my concern now is that the annuity will pay back mostly the money I have given to the insurance company. And true. When I die, the remaining balance is left to my family. What she's talking about, and we will get into deeper next week. That's why I wanted to get to this, kind of a teaser. This particular annuity from this insurance company, it does have a bogus. That's kind of how they lure you in with this bogus. And it has an income, a living income benefit. The income benefit is just giving her her money. And as long as she doesn't take out more than what they say she can every year, if she lives long enough and the annuity reaches zero, Then and only then does the insurance company kick in.
Right.
But all the while that she's holding this annuity with this rider, she's paying a fee every single year. So
fairly healthy fee, probably 3% or something, right?
Say what?
Probably a healthy fee, like 3% or so.
Oh, no, no. These fixed index annuities are not nearly as high as variable annuities. Remember, first of all, a fixed index annuity is a spread product. So the overt fees that have to be itemized separately in a variable annuity, the mortality expense, the administrative, all of that that gets itemized separately in a VA are rolled into the interest rate that this annuity pays, the cap rate rather. The cap rate of this annuity pales in comparison to
So that's where they're dinging her more so than an overt fee.
Absolutely.
Got it.
The cap rate of this particular fixed index annuity is low compared to a fixed indexed annuity without this income benefit rider.
Right.
So they lure you in. You're taking some of next week's show, but they lure you in with this income rider, but the cap rate is significantly lower.
Okay.
So there is, though, a separate itemized rider fee on this annuity. And I apologize that I do not know it anymore off the top of my head, but I would wager it's between 70 basis points and 110 basis points, with my gut telling me it's between 75 and 100 basis points. So that is a separately itemized fee, Chris. Then there, of course, is the spread, the difference between the cap rate and what they're going to keep. And the cap rate on this product is significantly lower than the cap rate on an annuity without this rider. So there is a fee, and she's starting to realize this. Okay. So she's going on to say, would I be better off cashing it out? I am not going to answer that question. I don't know you. I don't know your situation. I'm just going to answer, but we are not giving you specific yes, cash it out, no, keep it. Only you, the person who put you in it, or your current advisor, or all three of yous, can really come to that conclusion. If you, in fact, do have $750K in this, you got a hell of a lot of money in there. So I would want you to really think things through. Okay, anyway, she says, I lost my place in life. Would I be better cashing it out and putting it in a MYGA or a money market account, paying about the same payout that I could get of 4.5% and still have a larger sum left when I pass? What she's saying, listener, is the living benefit, her income benefit, is a 4.5% payout. Does she give her age, Chris? Does she put her age in here?
I haven't heard it.
No, she doesn't, damn it, because we could have seen how much she needed to put into a SPIA. So let's just assume she put $750,000 in it. Well, no, we have to guess. She said she put a third of her $3 million in it. Excuse me, a quarter of her $3 million in it. She has a living benefit rider of 4.5%. Meaning this annuity will give her 4.5% of $750,000 forever. What does that come to in dollars, Chris? And how long will this annuity, let's assume the growth stays neutral. How long does this annuity last?
So $33,750 a year is 4.5%. And that means it would take 22.25 years to get your money back.
So it'll take her about 22 years for her money to be returned. Mm-hmm. And she's starting to realize this. And she's starting to think, wait a minute, I can get a MYGA that pays more than my 4.5%. Would I be better off putting my money in the MYGA and living off of that 4.5% as opposed to the annuity? Or more than 4.5%, excuse me. I don't know, listener, because this product will, after 22 years,
keep paying you.
It'll keep paying you. You're confusing the interest of, you're not really confusing it, but this product is going to give you 4.5% a year. What I don't know is how much growth you're going to get. You're not, that's one missing element you need to analyze. Mm-hmm. I don't know what the cap rate of this annuity. So in other words, they're going to give you 4.5% of your $750,000 on day one. And the following year, they'll give you another 4.5%, which is, Chris said, $33,000. So on day one, they give you $33,000. 365 days later, you get another $33,000, and so on and so forth. You're just going to keep taking out $33,000. What I don't know is how much the remaining dollars are growing. Right. What is your potential cap rate? Because only if the distributions exceed the growth potential of the annuity will that annuity start to drop, reach zero, and then the insurance company is paying you out of their pocket. A 4.5% withdrawal benefit tells me, I've never been a fan of this annuity, and I'm not going to mention its name. It tells me you are very young, relatively speaking, because you have a much smaller withdrawal rate. That, yes, could be easily surpassed with a lot of fixed income investments right now that do pay more than 4.5. So you close and you walk away with 750, assuming you're over your penalty phase, and you put it in something that can pay you 5, 5.5, 5.25. That's great while it's paying you more. But there's no guarantee when that MYGA matures if the new one is going to pay you a higher rate than the 4.5. And with this product, if the annuity could earn more than the 4.5 that it's giving you, and your account balance can grow, you theoretically might get a quote-unquote pay raise in a given year because your account balance is growing. So it's hard for me to tell you if you should close this or not. But I do feel, and I think you'll concur, Chris, a 4.5% payout, that's low.
Well, I think it's probably 4.5% of the income base, and she got that bonus, so it's probably 20% higher than that on 750.
That is all true, correct. So she doesn't give us enough info.
Yeah, we're just going with some hypothetical numbers here. We don't have the whole story. And that income base might even have some kind of, although you're familiar with, I don't have the name of the annuity in front of me, but some of those, as you know, have a guaranteed doubling of the income base after 10 years and, you know, that kind of stuff. So there's other things going on in there that might be a benefit to her that if she's considering moving it, changing it, whatever, just closing it, she needs to have someone analyze all that for and see what she needs and see if this works for her and if it benefits her. And you don't want to give up something that's going to ultimately work well for you. With a knee-jerk reaction. Sounds like she might have knee-jerk reaction bought it because she's second-guessing why she has it, the benefits of having it. Let's not knee-jerk and make it worse, right? If it is something that she can benefit.
How she ends this, Chris, lends into exactly what you just said and lends into the simplicity of a spear. Here's how she ends this. There is some increasing benefit on the annuity based on performance with the funds. They're not funds, listener. They're indexing options. You are not investing your money in funds. They're just indexing options. There's some increasing benefit on the annuity based on performance with indexing options. She uses the word funds that I can choose. But I haven't had any luck picking the right ones. And I don't know if I should choose point to point or monthly sum. It varies year to year. I do think this annuity pays out double my payments, though, if I go into a nursing home.
So it has
on that, listener, be very careful.
Yeah.
Usually when your account balance reaches zero, the doubling stops. And the doubling sometimes may occur just for a certain number of years. So in other words, on these products with these doubling features, if you go into a nursing home, they're kind of sold like, oh my God, this is a great thing for long-term care. If this annuity's balance reaches zero, and personally it should, and we'll talk about this next week when I talk about living benefits, when my turn on mine better reach zero, and it better reach zero while I'm still alive. Because I didn't pay my damn insurance company every single year to die with money in it. I paid the insurance company a fee every single year so I would live long enough and get their money, not mine. And you want the same thing, listener. You want this account to reach zero. Most of these benefit riders that double, if the account balance reached zero, they will not double. Or if they reach zero during the doubling phase, the doubling stops. And they generally only double the payout for 5 years. Now, there are some annuities that will continue the doubling even if the account balance reaches zero, but they're rare. Just keep that in mind. It's how she ends it with this sentence. This annuity is so complicated, I'm thinking it may be better to cash it out. But the thought of guaranteed income after I stop work is comforting to me. That's the beauty of a single premium immediate annuity. I can all but guarantee you a single premium immediate annuity will pay you more than what this annuity is paying you. But yes, you don't have any money left. However, dollar for dollar, if you're only getting a 4.5% payout, I don't know your age, but if you're somewhere in your 60s and you're female and you're single, your single premium immediate annuity payments are probably in the sixes. I'm not quite sure if they'd hit sevens yet. Chris could look that up if he has time. But you're going to get a payout from a single premium immediate annuity significantly higher. Meaning, to get the same payout that you're going to get from this annuity, you would have to put less into a single premium immediate annuity. And all those dollars that are left over, those are yours. You can go and invest them. You're never going to lose those, and you can die with them. But inside this annuity, eventually you will have received all your money. You hope you had received all your money, and when you die, there's nothing left. This liquidity feature of a living benefit is a red herring. You hope you live long enough. Now, granted, you could die sooner. I concede that. But dollar for dollar, it's going to take significantly less money to generate the same income that 4.5% on $750 is going to. And all those extra dollars could be invested. And because you have this lifetime stream of guaranteed income backstop, you might feel more comfortable taking some growth risk with these. You talk about being confused and not understanding all the different indexing options and which ones to choose. How nice would it be to buy a nice little balanced ETF or low, I don't want to say low risk because every investment is going to have risk, but a lower risk investment if that appeals to you, or an indexing investment like a total stock market ETF with a 0.08 fee. And it just sits there. Because you have this pool of lifetime stream of guaranteed income. And all those extra dollars could be the inheritance, or it could be used to help with inflation. Because the annuity you have is not, chances of you getting a pay raise on that annuity is slim to none. But in this scenario that I just described to you, 5, 8, 10, 12 years into retirement, your payment's not going to be worth the same. Take some money from the investment account. Buy another annuity with it, or just take a little bit from the investment account and use that as some of your inflation adjustment. You will have more dollars outside of an annuity with a single premium immediate annuity if your goal is to match this 4.5% safe withdrawal rate. But do not rush into just closing this annuity and doing what I said. You need to look, like Chris just said, at all the elements of this annuity and talk to your advisor or the broker who put you in this. Now, the broker may not be too thrilled about this if this annuity is paying him or her a trail or something. Or they might love this idea because now they're going to have a chance to sell you another annuity. So just make sure that whoever you're getting your advice from is not being swayed one way or another, trying to manage your money with the extra assets or sell you another annuity and make a commission. But you do need to do some deep dives in, because I'm not convinced at a 4.5% withdrawal rate, this steak is worth its sizzle.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, don't make a questionable decision worse. I'm not questioning her. I think she's having questions is why I'm saying it that way. She's having questions and doubts about this, but don't just, this is a significant decision, right? She has $750,000 in this thing. She needs to make sure she's not going to compound the issue with another mistake, that harms her. So that's a perfect stopping spot unless you've got other things to say.
The other one is even longer, especially okay. The way you go on and on and
yeah,
on.
Yeah,
so,
for sure.
We'll have to lock it up here, but hopefully people are learning. Mm-hmm. And next week on the EDU show, assuming I make it back from Ohio on Monday, I intend to be recording with Chris on Tuesday, and we will dive into living benefits. So I'll be able to explain a little bit more of some of the concepts that Chris and I were discussing with this woman's answer.
Yeah, that sounds good. And if you want to send in your own questions for the Q&A show, just send them directly to Jim. Jim@jimhelps.com is the email address. That's jim@jimhelps.com. In the subject line, indicate that it's a question for the podcast and put a couple words about the topic. We're about to forge ahead into fewer annuity questions. So if you've been holding back during Annuity Awareness Month because you had a non-annuity question, now's the time to start sending those in. Sometimes we answer them right away, right? We, as you maybe noticed, we try to do a new question of the week. So you might get your question heard on the podcast relatively quickly. Other times, like you saw today, we had a question from 2023. So sometimes they'll linger or not be answered at all. So hopefully you've heard enough questions to know what style of questions we tend to gravitate towards. So give us a nice tight question with enough detail to answer, but maybe not an overtly huge amount of detail. Those usually are difficult to handle on a format like we have here. So we really appreciate everybody listening. And Jim, if I don't talk to you before you head out tomorrow, good luck on your trek back across the country. I'm sure we'll talk at some point, but good luck with all that. I'm sure you'll make it just fine. And everybody,
I hope so. I know I'll make it. It's will the mighty, massive, manly, macho Maverick make it?
Yeah, I think it should. I think you tested out nice. You already practiced it one time. I think it'll make it back just fine. So
true. It did make it out here okay.
Yeah.
But
that's
we shall see. It is pulling a huge 5x8 trailer.
Mm-hmm, huge. So anyway, everybody else, take care, and we'll be back with you next week with a brand new show.
You have listened to Jim on the radio, read his quotes in the media, and enjoyed his banter on iTunes. But even now, you may wonder what sets Jim Saulnier and Associates apart from other financial planning companies. The answer is quite simple. Jim's diverse team of professionals specializes in retirement planning. They form a lifelong relationship with you and measure their success not through product sales, but through the security and prosperity you may achieve in your retirement. Jim's entire team shares his unwavering commitment to placing their clients' best interests first while offering their services at fair prices with full disclosures. The professionals at Jim Saulnier & Associates are available to assist you with your retirement planning needs. Visit jimhelps.com to schedule your complimentary coffee and a second opinion meeting. That's jimhelps.com or call 970-530-0556.
The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested indirectly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Salnier and Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor.